Governor Holcomb says he needs more data on teacher pay. Holcomb also says the state did everything right in the Amazon worker death investigation. Plus, the State Board of Ed shifts some funding and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 3rd, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb is defending his timeline to hold off on major statewide action on teacher pay raises until 2021. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports that despite calls from teachers to send more funding to support schools in 2020, when lawmakers aren't likely to open the state budget.
Teachers' unions and Democratic lawmakers have called for more statewide action on teacher pay during the next legislative session. But Holcomb points to school funding measures passed in 2019, including a $150 million boost to help schools pay off teacher pensions and a slight bump in tuition support. He says he wants to know more about how school money gets to teachers' salaries before adding even more dollars to the mix.
And then now going into this next year, we're going to see where the gap remains.
The governor's Teacher Compensation Commission will make recommendations to lawmakers and the governor ahead of the 2021 session.
Will teachers be satisfied with Holcomb's approach? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, as we head into the 2020 session, will teachers be okay with this explanation?
Of course not, and they shouldn't be. I mean, what he is basically saying is after 3 years as governor and a short time as lieutenant governor, he doesn't know how half the state budget is allocated. What does that tell you about his tenure? I mean, we are well below the national average in teacher raises. We're now paying our teachers less than Kentucky pays theirs. There is no rocket science about this. He needs to fix the problem, and he doesn't need to postpone it because he doesn't want to spend the money. So teachers aren't going to be satisfied, and neither are the parents of the students in public education, which is, of course, 93% of the students in the state that are in K through 12 or in regular public education. They're not going to be satisfied because we have fewer people going to get teaching degrees to come into the system, and we have them retiring after 5 years. We lose a third of the workforce and of the new teachers within the 5 years of coming out because the pay is abysmal here. He knows that, okay? It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out. He just doesn't want to fix it.
There's a lot of merit, to the argument that this two-year commission is doing the work that it's already doing. It will come up with a menu of options for lawmakers to consider for a long-term sustainable plan in 2021. Right. But it feels like we just had that argument over road funding a few years ago, where we were coming up with a long-term sustainable solution that we did in 2017, but in the 2016 session, they passed some one-time short-term money to help the road funding issue. Why can't we just do the same thing for teachers now?
Well, I don't think it's the same thing exactly, and a couple things. So just last year, we did pass an additional $763 million for education funding, $1.6 billion since Governor Holcomb has been in office. And schools have been raising teacher pay. Over of the 301 schools that have reported this year, 299 of them have reported teacher salary increases. More than 50,000 teachers have gotten base salary increases, and more than what they did last time.
2%.
What I think is really frustrating is I believe that whoever is leading this cause, whether it's a national effort or state lobbyists or whoever it is, are doing teachers a disservice because they didn't set them up and let them know how the session works. It's not a budget session. So to make this big demonstration before this year is really, I think it's political. I really do.
It's political. They want to be paid for their work. That is a terrible policy.
You should inform your folks how the process works.
Well, the teachers are ours.
No, I'm saying if you're the lobbyist or you're the teachers group, you should let the teachers know how the process works and that these things don't happen in a budget session.
They know.
I just think it's unfortunate that it's going to be framed that way when that's just not the way it works.
They know
and
that
it does
if they
make sense
do
to wait for the commission to go through the process and come up with their report.
Delay,
another increase next year on top of the increase that they just got this year.
Couldn't Republicans put this entire thing to rest by putting a little bit of one-time money for a one-time bonus while saying to teachers, don't worry, the long-term fix is coming. And they are reopening the budget this session, whether they want to call it that or not, by spending excess state surplus dollars.
They could. It would help. I don't think it would satisfy everybody because the amounts that would be involved are not going to get people to where Ann, for instance, wants them to be. So would it be, it would force some people in that caucus to sort of be uncomfortable with breaking ranks with what with the approach that they have spelled out, and they think that this commission is the way they want to stick with it. It's not a budget year, as we've all made clear. And I think to do what you're suggesting wouldn't sit well with some of them, even though it might placate some. But don't think for a minute that it would take the issue off the table.
To this point Jennifer just made, I mean, we saw this big rally at the State House on Red for Ed Day, Red for Ed Day on Org Day, ahead of a non-budget session. Why wasn't that the rally before the 2019 budget writing session?
I just don't think they were organized enough yet. And frankly, I mean, I kind of get the idea, and I think I've mentioned it, the idea of a $1,000 good faith bonus to every teacher out of that $300 million in excess dollars. They could still build some buildings and give people basically something to say, hey, we're with you, we understand, we're working on a long-term answer, but in the meantime, here's a bonus. And to be honest, not only is that one-time money, but now after the latest budget revenue forecast, we have new ongoing money that's also available that we're not spending.
More than we thought we were going to.
And I just want to say, I mean, I get what the teachers are saying, but I'm getting tired of writing the same story, which is, hey, guys, not going to happen in 2021. You got to be honest. Republicans and the governor have made clear for about a year that it was not going to happen this session.
Yeah. Well, that's why you keep the pressure on, because when you're paying cash for capital improvements like they're doing with the extra money, and then you have extra ongoing money coming, and they don't want to address the problem, shame on them.
And keep in mind, too, that by having the rallies this session, it's not a budget session, but I don't think they were misinformed. They also have a different audience. It's not just lawmakers, it's the commission that's going to be looking at this, that's going to be bringing recommendations to the General Assembly. And if they didn't rally, they might be thought, well, everybody's happy. I mean, there's a few disgruntled people, but
that makes sense to me. But I do think talking to a lot of the teachers who were there, they don't know it's not a budget session.
It also makes sense, though, in terms of lawmakers who are going to be reelected, and they wanted to make an election a point too,
political.
Right. Well, Governor Eric Holcomb also insists that Indiana officials did everything right in an investigation into a worker death at an Amazon warehouse after a news story alleges state officials sought to, quote, manipulate that investigation to clear Amazon.
A state safety inspector in an article by Reveal says he investigated the death of an Indiana Amazon worker and found the online retail giant failed to properly train him. The inspector also secretly recorded a conversation between his boss and Amazon officials. The supervisor reportedly tells Amazon what she'll need to shift blame onto the worker, away from Amazon, and she tells the safety inspector the state will, quote, manipulate his citations. Holcomb insists that's all fine.
Could have used the word edit or modify or manipulate or when they go through negotiations to help companies in the state of Indiana improve on any shortcoming that might be out there. This is what they do. They work with the companies to improve those workplaces.
The article also alleges Holcomb directly interfered with the Amazon investigation, something Holcomb vehemently denies.
Jennifer Hollowell, I want to move beyond the allegations about Holcomb's involvement. He sent cease and desist letters. He said as strongly as he can, I was not involved in any way. I want to take him at his word completely and move on to the other conversation, which is you have an Indiana official on tape saying we're going to manipulate this investigation so that we shift the blame away from Amazon. Is that okay?
Well, first, I'm glad that we are moving beyond the kind of ridiculous conspiracy theory that the governor did something untoward. But in terms of how this process works, I mean, state law requires that the Department of Labor works with companies to address resolve these kinds of issues. And so that's not uncommon. It's how the process works. I think we could agree that we would like to see the wording be different, if you could modify how your conversation goes. But in terms of how these kind of cases unfold, I mean, there is always engagement with the company to address what's happened and correct, modify, put systems in place, and then figure out what sort of penalties and things go along with that. But I mean, the kind of substance of the conversation, I think, is what should happen. It's just maybe some wording that we'd like to change.
More than wording. And taking him at his word that he wasn't involved in it, as long as that official is in the state administration, how do you trust anything they put out? Anything. Because it isn't simply about the word, although the word manipulate is an interesting word to use, because that's exactly what they did. It wasn't about addressing the concerns workers legitimately have about whether they're adequately trained and whose responsibility that death was. It was a conspiracy on the part of that state official to shift the blame, saying, well, he was probably on drugs. I mean, you've got a worker who died, who left a family behind, and as if that death isn't enough, you want to blame him. I mean, that's what that administration has done. And as long as that official is part of the administration, you cannot trust any of those things. I agree, you work with them to say, okay, you screwed up here. How are you going to fix that? What are you going to do to compensate this employee's family? And what are you going to do as a fine? You don't say, well, let's just, you know, blame him because he was probably on drugs or drunk or some other thing, and then cut the fee or the fine down to nothing. I mean, the atmosphere is such that whatever the company wants is okay. And the workers and the safety of workers and workers, whether workers are dying on the job, is much more secondary to whether this is the kind of business climate that companies will want. And that is the message this administration is sending forward, whether Eric Holcomb was in that meeting or not.
Is there a problem here beyond word choice?
Probably. I don't know who to believe, but I do know there's a way to solve it, which is the state says that Amazon provided them evidence that this worker was indeed properly trained and that there's video of it. But that video hasn't been released. Release the video that shows he was properly trained on the equipment. I mean, no offense, but they've released the video of his actual death to reporters. But where is the evidence that Amazon indeed followed the rules? If they did, fine, let's move on.
And if they didn't?
Well, then they should be fined. As always, the process exists.
You know, it seems to me that saying this is standard operating procedure reminds me of a certain White House chief of staff who goes before reporters and says, well, quid pro quos, when we have to hold up funding, that's just what we do. That's get over it, you know, get over it. I'm hearing a sort of a get over it. But to Ann's point, I think that's right. The Department of Labor is statutorily obligated to work with companies. It's an educational process. But you have to have the hammer to get people interested in the education. And when you take that off the table first, or signal that you're taking it off the table first, there's not a whole lot of incentive at that point for anybody to amend a process or to put new safety protocols in place. So I don't think what we're seeing here, yes, we can all say that it's supposed to be a collaborative process, negotiation to come to a good outcome. That's not the same as saying, here's your get-out-of-jail-free card, go run with it.
Well, the Indiana State Board of Education approved a proposal that will cut state funding from some family and consumer science classes starting next year. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Ginny Lindsay explains that board members held a procedural vote at a recent special meeting.
Lawmakers made a change last spring that trickled down to the Department of Workforce Development's state funding shortlist for CTE or career technical education courses. But some classes that teach things like nutrition and personal finance didn't make the cut, prompting concerns from teachers, superintendents, and board members. Board member and teacher Greg Gastineau says, for some kids, those classes are vital.
As we go forward, we really need to emphasize the whole child.
The board approved the funding levels. By law, they have to, but schools can file an appeal with DWD.
Nikki Kelly, is cutting funding for these classes, which are often called life skills classes, is that a good move? And this is not just on the state board.
You know,
this
I don't know. I do want to make clear, overall funding for CTE classes is going up.
Absolutely.
They've basically reprioritized funding towards some things. I have to be really honest here. That's, we're talking about five classes. That's it, five classes. And I honestly don't know, do we need 9-10 weeks of nutrition and wellness? Do you need 9 or 10 weeks of adult roles and responsibilities? I mean, why can't this all be one class where you learn how to fill out your W-2, you know,
balance your checkbook,
learn how to, you know, make a store list. I noticed that a lot of kids take these classes and then don't go on. That was one of the criticisms. Well, to me, all I'm seeing from a parent kind of situation is it's a blow-off class. I have a feeling a lot of these kids are taking those classes because it's an easy A and it's not really hard.
Yeah, is that perhaps that it feels like they're sending a bad message, but the real message is maybe these specific classes weren't working the way we hoped?
Well, maybe they weren't working the way we had hoped, but when you look at what they were intended to do, they are sort of society's biggest problems for that age group. Yes, preparing people for the workforce is the lofty goal, but if you have people who can't relate with the person next to them on the team, a supervisor, a subordinate, at that fundamental level, that's a problem. If you don't even know how to eat properly, and we look at the health, where you know, life expectancies are going down for the first time in the U.S., that's a problem. And I know I've heard a lot in my own, if I use my kids as a focus group, you know, personal finance, I wish I'd had more. You know, how do you write a check? I thought Venmo was took care of that. But there are certain things that there is a hunger for. Now, I don't know if they need to be, you know, a full semester, a 9-week course. Maybe there is some way to lump them together. But it does seem ironic that some of the societies, what we say are some of society's biggest problems that start in youth in terms of healthful eating or lack thereof, or not having a good sense of financial management and budgeting, well, that's the things we're apparently taking away. And it just seems to be a disconnect
of
sorts.
Well, they're not taking them away.
I know,
I know.
You're right.
They're just not giving them extra
funding. Right, right.
Well, but, you know, a lot of times with schools the way they are, if they're not giving them the funding they were expecting, sometimes those things just
go away. Well, I mean, they don't give them extra funding for Spanish class either. I mean,
doesn't this, though, again, maybe talking more about the message it feels like this sends. When we hear from employers at the State House when we're talking about workforce development, what do we consistently hear? It's
soft skills.
Isn't that exactly what this is? Shouldn't this be part of a robust workforce development-oriented curriculum?
I think some of it is. I struggle with this a little bit because I think some of it is, and I think that it's important that kids are getting soft skills, that they are learning budgeting and credit cards and loans and mortgages and all kinds of things that they're going to have to deal with in life. And, you know, we didn't learn it was when I was in school. And so I think that there should be some sort of class that's geared toward that, that maybe does qualify. But to me, I think this is more about shifting the CTE dollars to the higher level, advanced manufacturing, IT, other things that are preparing kids to go into the workforce, which is what CTE was, I think, aimed for. So I don't necessarily quarrel with it, but I do hope in some way that we're still teaching some of these things in these classes in some sort of curriculum.
The state board member kind of alluded to the idea of educating the whole child. Are schools educating the whole child?
I see too many young people coming out that lack a lot of these skills. They have no idea when they, for example, charge things on credit cards, they may be paying 30% or 36% interest and what that means. They have no idea that if they put their vacation on the credit card that they're going to owe it for 5 years. Those kinds of things are pretty basic. And the problem is, yes, if you're not taught it in school and your IQ is hard enough, high enough, you're going to pick it up later. But it's exactly those kids that don't have the family support that need to understand a lot of these things, and we have to educate them because, you know, workforce development has had a pretty poor record of picking what the next job of the future is going to be. And there may not be those jobs in the future. It may be all computerized or artificial intelligence. So we have to teach those life skills to the students who need to have them in school, however you do it.
Yeah, because then the only way they learn it is the hard way.
Yeah. In bankruptcy.
I can speak from experience. That's not a lot of fun. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should the state move funding away from family and consumer science classes, sometimes known as life skills classes, A, yes, or B, no? Last week's question, which actually goes back a couple of weeks, will President Trump win re-election in 2020? 26% of you say yes, 74% say no. I feel comfortable in predicting it will be a lot closer than that on Election Day in November. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, 207 members of Congress this week signed on to a brief at a U.S. Supreme Court case asking the court to review and overturn legalized abortion.
The brief in a Louisiana abortion rights case refers to previous Supreme Court rulings, Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, that established a right to legal abortion. It calls those cases unworkable and urges the nation's high court to reconsider and, if appropriate, overrule those earlier decisions. Both Indiana U.S. Senators Todd Young and Mike Braun signed on to the brief. So, too, did five of the state's seven Republican House members. The only GOP members of Indiana's congressional delegation that didn't ask the Supreme Court to overturn legal abortion are 9th District Representative Trey Hollingsworth and 5th District Rep. Susan Brooks, who is retiring.
John Schwanis, does anything here surprise you?
Well, there's no hiding the agenda anymore. I mean, just that's out there in a way that perhaps, yes, there were always people who wanted to see Roe v. Wade overturned, but it was always sort of, let's nibble here, let's nibble there, not this sort of, let's come out and say, overturn it.
Overturn it.
That's one. The other thing, Trent Hollingsworth, being an outlier, you look at how he's voted and how he's been received by constituents in the past. He has 100%, I think, with Indiana pro-life groups. He's a darling of that constituency. And he's a zero, if I'm not mistaken, in the last ratings for NARAL, pro-choice organization. So I don't know what that says about the 9th District, being what tea leaves he's reading, but it just strikes me that given his track record, it doesn't make a lot of sense given what he's done in the past and what stances he has taken.
Yeah, did this email just go to Trey Hollingsworth's spam folder by accident? Is that what we think happened here?
Yeah, I don't know. I was surprised that he didn't sign on to it as well. I mean, I think it's been clear that they want this issue relitigated before a conservative court. You know, you might question whether there are some separation of powers issues kind of being tread upon, but we'll see what the court does.
Susan Brooks perhaps makes sense, both given her district and the fact that she's retiring, so you feel like it's
so
a lot easier to take a pass. Or it's just a lot easier to just take a pass on all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Does this from Hollingsworth, do you signal anything about the 9th District, or is this just a coincidence?
Obviously, he needs to pay a little bit more attention to whatever email or request he gets, because I don't think this reflects the 9th District. I don't think his stance on this reflects the 9th District. But it does reflect the Republican Party. I mean, it's clear that the agenda is to take away the right to choice completely and also to restrict birth control even. And then they wonder why they have trouble recruiting women candidates and why there are fewer women in the Senate and the House with the Republican label than there used to be. I mean, they have made it clear that the issue of women's control over reproductive rights is an issue that they think that the federal government has a complete role in. And I don't think that reflects what the voters want.
This, going back to what John said right at the start, which was this states it as plainly as it could. They want to overturn Roe. They want to end legal abortion. Is that just where we are? I mean, does that change anything in voters' minds, having it stated so plainly?
I don't know whether it does or not. I mean, I do think certainly I don't disagree with what John has said. I mean, there have been a lot of folks who have wanted to see this happen for a long time. I think this is a big symbolic gesture in that direction. As for Congressman Hollingsworth, he has a solid pro-life voting record. Yeah. I don't think there's any question about his stance on the issue.
Yeah.
He has a policy not to join on to amicus briefs and things that are outside his committee jurisdiction. And I think he also may believe there's issues with regard to separation of powers and let the courts do what the courts do, and he'll continue to vote for legislation
in
Congress.
That's certainly a kinder explanation than he needs to check his email more often.
All right, well, next week marks the start of the 2020 legislative session, so very quickly I'm going to ask for a couple predictions. First, Brian Bosma is going to depart as Speaker of the House right before the end of session. Obviously, that's hanging over his head throughout the session. So will that have an impact on the 2020 session? I'll go to you first, Jen Holloway.
I think it will have an impact. I think that it will define the way that some things happen throughout session. But I mean, he's a strong leader. He's been a strong leader for a long time. So I don't know that it exactly changes how issues may take shape, but it will have an impact.
Will his departure, impending departure, have an impact?
I don't think so, since he's already designated the heir apparent. I think it's going to go pretty smoothly.
And then finally, biggest storyline out of the 2020 session, Nikki Kelly.
I'm going to call it the do-nothing session. They're starting late, leaving early, and making very clear they don't want to do much.
Right.
If we have this extra revenue, maybe we should spend it. That's the theme we'll be heard, repeated often.
All right. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.